Love song. How should I hold my soul so that it does not touch on yours? How should I lift it beyond you to other things? Oh, I would gladly shelter it amidst lost shadows of some forgotten spot where it might not swing when your depths stir. But all that touches us, yes, everything brings us together, like the bowstring, which pulls from two strings a single chord. Over what instrument are we so tightly drawn? By the hand of which violinist are we thus born? Oh, sweet song. Rainer Maria Rilke, New Poems. Who translated? I don't know. It's a ripped piece of paper that's been floating around from folder to folder. Slow song. I'm just looking through some random things before I go to Greece the day after tomorrow for a week to eat olives and read poetry by the water. The bird in Switzerland was a magpie, by the way. And this bird? A Phoebe bird from the Ruth Stone house. I was sleeping on the porch on the last night of our Bring Your Bones manuscript retreat that just ended, and Ruth wrote so many poems about the porch and on the porch, and so many people have come and gone on that porch. So if you've seen the documentary, you know, you know. But the Phoebe birds come back every year, generation after generation. Its song will begin this podcast today. If you want to join our August retreat, The Poetics of Matter, that I'm teaching with the genius poet Matthias Lavina from August 3rd through 9th, please contact me, go to roostonhouse.org, sign up. We still have some spaces left, and I can't speak higher of how incredible it was last year doing The Poetics of Nothing. All these themes that I talk about on the podcast are what we talk about together, Matthias and I, are kindred spirits in these discussions, and we bring you into it so fully. And then we also have poetry workshops, so we get to work on your poems, and then we get to have these rich discussions with secondary readings around the theme of matter, and this time around. So we're going to be talking about objects of the world and just the matter of the poem too. And just all the paradoxes between seen and unseen, interior and exterior, will continue together. And also, I should say that if you don't want to share your poems in workshop, you can still come and just do the craft parts with us, or just participate in workshop without showing your poems. It's also, I'm also happy to talk anything about the retreat. If you have questions, please contact me, bianca@roostonhouse.org. So yesterday I went to talk to the Rutland County Retired Educators Society luncheon on the at the steakhouse on Route 7 South, look for a luncheon. And right by the indoor golf venue, I brought Odette and her friend with me because I was watching them at the time. It was really funny. I don't know. It's strange to walk into a room of, 200 retired educators in Rutland County with our mashed potatoes and our mac and cheese and in our coffee, and think about what to say to them about poetry. I love these kinds of situations. These are the best moments as a working poet in the world. to sort of say, okay, well, I bet most of these people haven't read a poem in a long, long time, besides maybe the occasional Mary Oliver or Shel Silverstein being read to their kids. But they were educators, so I was thinking about that aspect of their lives as people who devoted their time to the educational system, usually at a grade school level. I think that was the idea here. And then to be retired from doing that work of imparting information to the minds of the children. And then I love that they, you know, have this organization where they get together and keep being educated themselves, I think, with these talks that they have at their luncheons, and to have this community still, and people they worked with. And so gathering together, I as retirees of the educational system, this is some of the thoughts that I had that I wrote down and some of the poems I read them. I'm just going to riff off of it right now for you guys. What it means to have given over one's knowledge for a lifetime and then finished that, and then also reflecting on the idea of having to teach in a certain way that the system requires you to teach, which is very limiting, but that even within the laws of our institutions that employ us and help us with our livelihood, how we can have a healthier relationship with our minds and the words on the page in front of us and what we're presenting to one another as knowledge shared and received and given, gifted knowledge. It's funny how we think we know what we're doing. I don't know. I was thinking about the function of the poet in our world and what my function as the Vermont Poet Laureate is. I talked a lot about that with them. What does a poet laureate do? What's my function? Educating. I mean, I get asked that question a lot. I think probably more than any other question is, what does a poet laureate of Vermont do? I mean, essentially, it's an honorary position, so you just have to keep being yourself. That task is an interesting one. What does it mean to be myself? I'm always trying to have a more sincere relationship with poetry and with myself. This in its essence is the internal education system. Yes. Who are the authorities of that institution, I'd like to know. So I get to write poems and think about poetry and talk about poetry with people in rooms. My project as a poet laureate has always been getting people into rooms together and then reading them good poems, not mine, other people's. I will read them mine, but I can thread my poetry into my conversation. It doesn't need to be my poems from my books necessarily. To arrive in these places and give poetry a voice, to address the question of what it means to be a poet, what it means to be a laureate, like, I think the first honored, the honorary inaugural poet laureate was Homer. There's that amazing painting where it's just like all the poets and thinkers and everybody just surrounding Homer, like just at the center with his laurel leaf. But Apollo, we should devote some time to Apollo, some episode. But Apollo, yes, is the laurel leaf of Daphne, which he wore on his head. He too is one of the inaugural laureates of poetry and song. Right, so addressing that question with people in rooms is part of my project at all times, to talk about the questions themselves about what it is in itself poetry and so fulfilling and rich, because it's not an answer really. It's okay, what does it mean to do this, to write these poems and then give them over? Because it's not coming in and saying I know what it means. That's what the poem itself is arriving, not knowing fully its function. It takes time to understand. How many times am I going to say this? It takes time to understand. It should take time. The question of how a poem means, how meaning is made, how ignorance functions. Oh, God. Oh, I cried this morning thinking about my ignorance in a good way. A good way. I shouldn't have said that. Well, I can delete it later. Or I can let it sit. My own error. Let it hang out there. How it takes time to understand poetry and to understand what it means to be a poet and how the poet functions in the social spheres. We're frightened and intrigued, I think, by poetry. And excited and wary of it. I was thinking how sometimes when I'm teaching or I'm talking to people in master's programs, or people especially, you know, they want books, they want to be published, they want to be better poets. I think to myself, well, this excitement about being a poet, and yet so much of what I'm seeing is almost missed the point about being a poet. So what is the fracture here in our understanding of poetry, as in our education of what it means to be a poet and how to engage with poetry and bring it into our lives? I mean, that's really what's lacking in the education system. You know, we bring the poems themselves in and we say this is poetry, is this Robert Frost poem or this haiku, and then it just sort of stops there. I think the whole conversation about feelings and expressing feelings is very misleading in a way, because that's almost like a side effect of the poem, is the feelings that get lobbed off like little frayed pieces of a shirt, like little pieces of feather off of a bird that fall down. It feels good to shed a little bit at all times. You know, we're just walking around intact and yet falling apart. It's so interesting to have these bodies. I think that's what poetry does. It just keeps things moving around. It keeps feelings circulating. Ah, the Mobius strip of grief. And yet that's not the core of the strangeness of language at work here. The weirdness of meaning. How can you talk about feelings when you're talking about ignorance and meaning? So, yes, I mean, I think you can talk about the two together, because when you have feelings, it's not really like you can translate them into meaning, except that, I mean, grief is grief. I guess the meaning of grief is loss, but, and grieving what you can't get back or never had. We come to the idea of absence and lack and nothingness again and again. But also, I'm getting distracted. I did not say this to the poor retired educator society of Rutland County. No, I didn't. But I didn't not say this either. I don't hold back with them. God, their faces, it was kind of amazing. So, frustrated, frightened, intrigued, and excited and wary of poetry. All indication that poetry and poems are like humans themselves. Yes, because people are frustrating and exciting and frightening. And beautiful. God, so beautiful, their voices. Even the most beautiful people, a little disgusting as well. That's always nice to see. It's the little hideousness and beauty, and the beauty and hideousness puts us all on the same page, you know? The way language coaxes out something that helps us live more fully in our lives to bring us back into right relation with ourselves and one another. There's one of my favorite lines, not even mine. Rift from Edward Hirsch. So it's normal to not like poetry. I don't like poetry all the time. They all laughed at that. It's normal to not understand poetry. I don't understand poetry any more than I really understand my fellow man, the people I love who are right in front of me, who I love the most. I don't understand them. I don't know if I want to. I just want to feel that engagement of being together. I want to see them. I want to have that incredible moment of seeing them. It's so much like letting go of feeling like you're not getting something from them that you want, or that they're resentful of you for not giving them something. How we go around it, that state, in that state at all times. I mean, I think we do. I don't think it's just me with my formative, disrupted relations. No, I don't think so. I think we all go up with these little walls unfolded and put it around us like, oh, we could just fold them back up again and set it aside, the little dividing wall, and look at somebody. I love these little moments that I have sometimes when I fall in love with someone during workshop. I look at them and suddenly see them and I feel such love, and I just, it's like a tension in the air of it is really incredible, because you just want to give everything to them in that moment and just sit there looking at them and wonder, just this ordinary person. It's not a physical eroticism in the way that you want to possess their body, but you appreciate the body, the matter of them, the look of their skin, the way that they are, their beauty and their ugliness right there. It's like there's no difference between those two things. It's so much better than trying to seem a certain way and to manipulate things in order to get, to just fall apart in a way in front of one another while still being intact in a body. Hey, let's read a poem called Wild Asters by Ruth Stone. How many times have I read this poem? I've memorized it. I'm kind of obsessed with like a handful of poems right now, and they just keep circulating. So this is one of them, Wild Asters by Ruth Stone. When I think about the function of a poet, this is a good poem for that. I'm here to worship the blue asters along the brook, not to carry pollen on my legs or rub strutted wings in mindless sucking, but to feel with my eyes the loss of you and me, not in the powdered mildew that spreads from leaf to leaf, but in the glorious absence of grief, to see what was not meant to be seen, the clusters, the aggregate, the undenying multiplicity. I remember when I arrived at the luncheon, I was kind of in a a state of terrible anxiety, and I've been so good with that, but sometimes right before an event, it's sometimes, well, there's just what's happening, and one has to get up in front of everybody. It's sort of, all right, let's do this. But the good thing is that I have the poems, and this kind of conversation really is so real that the anxiety has to just use itself towards that, and it's like a sublimation of anxiety in the best way. Anyway, I was worried about what I was going to say in front of them and how they were going to take it. But then before we had lunch, everybody prayed, and it gave me hope. I felt, I was like, okay, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Then I read them another one of my favorite poems, which is Theodore Rutke's In a Dark Time. From the far field. I love that book. I love his poem, Journey to the Interior. Maybe I'll read that on the next podcast. And The Rose. Oh, The Rose. Is it from the far field? It's section 4. Sequence, sometimes metaphysical. That's such a great title for a section. Sequence, comma, sometimes metaphysical. In a Dark Time by Theodore Rutke. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. I meet my shadow in the deepening shade. I hear my echo in the echoing wood. A lord of nature weeping to a tree. I live between the heron and the wren. Beasts of the hill and serpents of the den. What's madness but nobility of soul at odds with circumstance? The day's on fire. I know the purity of pure despair. My shadow pinned against a sweating wall. That place among the rocks, is it a cave or winding path? The edge is what I have. A steady storm of correspondences. A night flowing with birds, a ragged moon. And in broad day, the midnight come again. A man goes far to find out what he is. Death of the self in a long, tearless night. All natural shapes blazing unnatural light. Dark, dark my light, and darker my desire. My soul, like some heat-maddened summer fly, keeps buzzing at the sill. Which eye is I? A fallen man, I climb out of my fear. The mind enters itself, and God the mind. And one is one, free in the tearing wind. In some ways, I think poetry is like prayer, in that it's filled with silence to address the unseen. In some ways, I think poetry gets to a space beyond ourselves, of course, and that we need to have these kinds of sacred moments with the unseen. The eye is I, the is one, free in the tearing wind, the glorious absence of grief, to see what is not meant to be seen. These are the moments. Poetry will always be harder to touch because this is a hard threshold to stand upon, let alone cross. It's also a place of grief because there's so much we don't understand about being in this world and where we go when we leave it. Where does the beloved go? This Mobius strip of grief, we traverse it. The poet deals in thresholds, and we're poised in moments that need to get beyond words. Wordsworth called them, quote, fallings from us, vanishings. The writer, Alan Williamson, calls them moments when, quote, an eruption of our inner life takes us out of the shared social world, partly because that world has no terms by which to acknowledge such moments. Poetry can do pioneer work at the margins of the sayable, where the genres that belong entirely to communal experience, the sermon, the political tract, the popular song, and even storytelling insofar as it derives from the group in the tavern or around the village well, are not allowed to go. So these genres that belong entirely to the communal experience, they're not allowed to go to these unsayable places. And Celestial Music by Louise Gluck. I have a friend who still believes in heaven, not a stupid person, yet with all she knows, she literally talks to God. She thinks someone listens in heaven. On earth, she's unusually competent, brave too, able to face unpleasantness. We found a caterpillar dying in the dirt, greedy ants crawling over it. I'm always moved by weakness, by disaster, always eager to oppose vitality. But timid, also, quick to shut my eyes, whereas my friend was able to watch, to let events play out according to nature. For my sake, she intervened, brushing a few ants off the torn thing, and set it down across the road. My friend says I shut my eyes to God, that nothing else explains my aversion to reality. She says I'm like the child who buries her head in the pillow so as not to see, the child who tells herself that light causes sadness. My friend is like the mother, patient, urging me to wake up an adult like herself, a courageous person. In my dreams, my friend reproaches me. We're walking on the same road, except it's winter now. She's telling me that when you love the world, you hear celestial music. Look up, she says. When I look up, nothing. Only clouds, snow, a white business in the trees, like brides leaping to a great height. Then I'm afraid for her. I see her caught in a net deliberately cast over the earth. In reality, we sit by the side of the road, watching the sunset. From time to time, the silence pierced by a bird call. It's this morning we're both trying to explain the fact that we're at ease with death, with solitude. My friend draws a circle in the dirt. Inside, the caterpillar doesn't move. She's always trying to make something whole, something beautiful, an image capable of life apart from her. We're very quiet. It's peaceful sitting here, not speaking. The composition fixed, the road turning suddenly dark, the air going cool, here and there the rocks shining and glittering. It's this stillness that we both love. The love of form is a love of endings. What do you say after such a poem? Maybe I'll say that in the head is an ocean. It's dark, and we're in it. We can't touch, enter, or truly know one another, can we? To cry out into such an ocean is so strange. It's an ocean with vast expanses of nothing. The voice is so small as to be a sigh in a hurricane. And yet it is the most desperate cry we make. A rhythm carries flotsam towards and away. A synchronistic resonance is found in another. How is it like that? Someone delights at the code sent this way. I hear you between meaning and the untranslatable line of poetry. Sound moves through the water from some great lungs into me. A sense of direction pulls the heart and mind, if so surrendered. The moon dictates. What is illuminated is only the surface. Things appear and are swept away. Cargo from ships that belong to no party, and yet they're ours. Returning home, these strange and familiar messages. The poem bobs in its bottle, always to its destination. Thank you.